we are in this pandemic that's been ongoing for about 1.5 years now. There has been no actual investigation of how it began.
We know it's likely COVID-19 came from a bat, but how did it get to us? From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. While the origin story is still being pieced together, the life-saving answers in aerosol science are just beginning to get their due.
What the past year has demonstrated to people is that aerosol science isn't just about climate change and hairspray, but it has this whole other application in the world of infectious diseases.
Plus, a buzzword among online futurists is the metaverse. But human beings have always looked for ways to escape reality.
I see a lot of similarities between drug experiences and virtual worlds and video games, too. Even the Travis Scott concert on Fortnite definitely felt like a very surreal, trippy experience.
It's all coming up after this.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Bob Garfield is out this week, and as many of you know by now, every week, having been fired after a warning and other efforts at amelioration for a pattern of bullying behavior. The entire staff agreed with that decision. The problem was not over-passionate discourse. We don't fear that. We've even put some of our own on the radio. Nor was it merely about yelling. But there's not much more I can say. Look, you know how this works. One side, as an individual, is free to present their case however they see it or wish to see it. They may describe their conduct in ways the other side might not even recognize. But that other side cannot engage because they're part of a bigger enterprise that balances many concerns, including legal ones. I know it's unsatisfying, as much for a show as deeply devoted to transparency as ours, as for some of you. But even if we could be totally transparent, the view would likely still be obscured under a heap of he said, they said. In the end, it really comes down to trust. Most especially and relevantly in the show, and what it offers today, next week, and the week after that. And so, dear listeners, on with the show. Back when the pandemic started so many lifetimes ago, we, that is to say, all the humans on the planet, were faced with a host of questions. How does the virus that causes COVID-19, called SARS-CoV-2, spread? How do we protect ourselves? And somewhere further down the list, amid so much confusion and loss, how did it start infecting humans?
As scientists work to contain the coronavirus, researchers are still trying to figure out where it came from. Early research suggests humans picked up the coronavirus from animals, possibly bats.
We know it's very similar to the virus in the bat, but did it go through an intermediate species? So this is a question we all need answered.
One possible scenario emerged early and then promptly retreated from mainstream scientific discourse, the theory that it had leaked from a lab. It's an idea that hinges on two key facts. One, that the first outbreak of the virus occurred in Wuhan, China. And two, that Wuhan is the home to the Wuhan Institute of Virology, a lab that studies active coronaviruses like SARS-CoV-2. That a lab leak could have been the source of this coronavirus seemed at first, to a layperson, at least plausible. but it was quickly swatted down when an international group of scientists published an open letter in The Lancet in February 2020 condemning, quote, conspiracy theories suggesting that COVID-19 does not have a natural origin.
Most scientists think that bats are the original source of the virus, and then it jumped to humans in a Wuhan wet market.
Too many perfect coincidences would have had to take place for it to have escaped from a lab.
There is also no reason to believe any of these conspiracy theories that it was leaked from the lab in Wuhan, whether intentionally or otherwise.
One group, however, saw a political opportunity in the lab leak theory. It's the same group that was banging on about the China virus.
Both President Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo linked the virus to a lab in Wuhan without providing evidence.
Have you seen anything at this point that gives you a high degree of confidence that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was the origin of this virus?
Yes, I have.
Thus, it became a notion embraced by the conspiratorial right, but mostly shunned by the scientific community. And scientists who did explore it, people like Alina Chan of the Broad Institute at Harvard and MIT, were tarred as conspiracy theorists. That is, until this month, when a group of 18 prominent scientists, some of the most trusted virologists and epidemiologists studying COVID-19, penned an open letter in the journal Science titled, Investigate the Origins of COVID-19. Alina Chan was one of them.
Yes, I think this letter will go down in history as being the turning point when scientists, leading scientists, say that we have to investigate the lab leak hypotheses.
None of the scientists assert that the virus did, in fact, leak from a lab. They merely ask for, quote, a dispassionate science-based discourse on the issue. And they offer a critique of the one major WHO, quote, investigation into the origins of the virus conducted by a team of international scientists, half of whom were China-based. It was the Chinese team that actually did the investigating, gathering, processing, and ultimately holding on to the data. To those who penned the open letter, the result was extremely unsatisfying.
This was not an investigation at all. They had no power. So all they could do was really look at the findings of the Chinese side of the team and think, is this reasonable? And then sign off on the document altogether to present it to the world in March of this year.
The Chinese team had four different hypotheses.
So the first was a bat-to-human direct transmission, that a virus that was in bats jumped directly into humans. The team said that it was possible, but they didn't say it was the most likely scenario because there has been no record of such a transmission happening, at least not publicly.
What was the most likely?
That is the second scenario, where a bat first gives the virus to an animal that is more similar to humans, and then that animal gives it to humans. So it requires an intermediate host.
I remember the film Contagion. It came from a bat to a pig to a human.
Yes, exactly. And in SARS-1, it was civet cats.
Mm-hmm. Then there's the third scenario, the possibility of a lab leak. The Chinese team really didn't like that hypothesis.
The China WHO team said that it was extremely unlikely and decided not to pursue this route of investigation or study any further. That report, it was the trigger for a lot of scientists to say, we need to speak up, say that a lab leak hypothesis is still plausible and worth investigating.
Then there's the frozen food scenario. The Chinese team seemed to like that one.
Yes, and again, this was another hypothesis that was very surprising to a large number of scientists. There's no precedent of a virus jumping from frozen foods into humans, as far as I know. In fact, even with this many millions of people infected, there's been no proven record of someone catching SARS-2 from a block of frozen fish or frozen meat. But yet, the China WHO team said that this was more likely than the lab leak hypothesis, which actually has precedent. SARS virus itself has leaked from a lab close to 6 times.
We know that this argument isn't merely of historical interest.
We need closure. This pandemic has affected so many lives and it's killed 3.5 million people. And we need to mitigate this kind of risk. If it did come from animals, especially illegally trafficked animals, it can help us put all the weight we have against this sort of trafficking. But if it came from a lab, even if it came from well-intentioned research, then we have to start regulating that research. This is research that sends researchers into remote areas to collect novel viruses and bring them back into densely populated cities for study. This sort of work has been pitched as pandemic predicting and preventing work, but if it actually is the source of new pandemics, then we need to have a good hard think about how we should do this sort of research in the future.
Just to clarify, nobody who signed this letter is saying that a lab leak did cause the pandemic, just that it warrants investigation, right?
Yes. And I think that's one challenge that has really obstructed the investigation of this hypothesis since the beginning, because anyone who raised the hypothesis of a lab leak was accused as sort of warmongering, as saying that this definitely came from a lab.
That anyone who suggested there was a lab leak was spreading misinformation.
There were some scientists who came out very strong at the beginning of the pandemic, when barely anything was known about the virus, said that it's clear that this is from nature. No lab-based scenario is plausible. And these works are published in The Lancet and Nature Medicine. So when you have that, then the rest of the scientific community and science journalists tend to fall in line. That set the tone for the rest of the discussion for the year, I think.
The February 2020 letter in Lancet, the first draft of it was written by a Peter Daszak, who actually had a stake of a kind in the Wuhan lab.
Peter Daszak, he's the president of an EcoHealth Alliance, a nonprofit organization based in New York. They received millions of dollars of funding, and part of that money was sent to the Wuhan Institute of Virology.
Let's get back to the politics for a second. In early 2020, both China and the United States started slinging theories around that China intentionally created this virus. And then there were others who said it actually came from a lab in the United States.
Yes, I think the circumstantial evidence points away from an intentional release. As to whether there was bioweapons work, like, who can tell? Most of the viruses that have escaped from labs are collected from nature. They don't need to be Frankenstein chimera built in the lab. They don't have to be bioweapons. Nature already has a lot of good stuff. It already has a lot of very scary, dangerous viruses that we can bring back into the lab and accidentally leak.
But isn't part of the problem with the resistance to looking into an accidental lab leak the fact that it has been shuffled in with these other conspiracy theories?
Yes, and so I kind of understand why some scientists were in such a rush to condemn any idea of a lab leak, because they wanted to strongly shut down any conspiracy theories about bioweapons. I understand that, but I also think that they should have more publicly explain this nuance. On the last day of 2019 and the first day of 2020, when the Beijing CDC went to sample the Wuhan market, they collected hundreds of samples from this market, including from all the animal carcasses, as well as the environment. So the surfaces, doorknobs, sewers, and there were no animal samples with this virus in it. In fact, if you read their reports, they said that there were no live mammals at this market. So it's a live animal market, but they were selling live frogs and reptiles and snakes. None of these are hosts of SARS-CoV-2 virus. There was no way for an intermediate host to be spilling over this virus into humans at that market.
Can you talk about some of the scientific misconceptions that have caused confusion around the origins of COVID-19?
One major misconception is that this SARS research at the WIV was conducted in such a safe, high biosafety level that it could never have leaked. All of this work was done at much less safe levels than people thought.
But there are a lot of labs doing this kind of work. Are there similar lapses in safety measures in all of them, including the US?
Yes, even labs with no reported biosafety incidents have biosafety incidents. If there are no accidents ever in your lab, that means you're not doing any experiments. And so in the case of the first SARS virus, it escaped from a lab in Singapore, it escaped from BSL-4 in Taiwan, it escaped about four times from a single lab in Beijing when it was being studied back in 2004. And none of these scientists were doing anything crazy with the virus. One of them didn't even work with the virus. Somehow it had contaminated his sample and he got sick. Another massive misconception is that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was built there because it's a SARS hot zone. That is completely untrue. The strongest route by which a SARS virus could get all the way from its home in South China, more than 1,000 miles into Wuhan, is, in my opinion, actually dozens of lab personnel crawling into these extremely difficult to reach caves, bringing thousands of bat samples back into the crowded city of Wuhan. It's a very modern city.
All of this makes one think that maybe we shouldn't be doing that kind of research. And you're afraid that people will come precisely to that conclusion.
It's important for us to understand what is out there. I think it's very valuable. It's not that this research should not be done. The question is, how can we make it safer? So maybe we shouldn't be doing it right smack next to an international airport. Maybe we should be doing it in a place where researchers are required to quarantine for 2 weeks or more between working at those locations and coming back into where there are millions of people in the city. There are ways to make this research safer while still doing it.
All you're asking for is an investigation. In an effort to protect scientific research, has the scientific community run the risk of undermining its own credibility?
Yes. This science letter that was just published really is a call to return back to science-based discourse. For me, the mistake would be for scientists to show the public that, no, we cannot check ourselves, we cannot audit ourselves. Scientists need to take the leadership, reviewing the research that we've been doing and saying, could this have caused the pandemic? This is a precedent-setting situation. So this is the first time there's been such a plausible scenario of a lab leak resulting in a pandemic. We really need to establish a protocol and a system where we can investigate no matter where the next possible lab leak pandemic occurs. Because if we don't investigate, then we keep letting these pass and we keep letting it go. We're just going to enter an era of lab-based pandemics. So it's just going to be every 5 to 10 years a new virus escaped from a high-security lab. We can't let that happen.
Alina, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Alina Chan is a postdoctoral researcher at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard. Coming up, how an argument over aerosols and droplets probably cost us a whole lot of lives. This is On the Media.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The media, which polls suggest inspire meager trust these days, is further bedeviled when it's joined at the hip with science, decoding research for mass consumption, clarifying a daily barrage of new statistics, and putting guidelines into context is complicated. But it's further tangled up when the communication breakdown occurs among the scientists themselves. Case in point, the novel coronavirus that shut down much of the world cracked open a decades-old inconsistency previously papered over in how different kinds of scientists talk about infectious disease. It didn't matter much until it really did. At the center lay one measurement, 5 microns, or 5 millionths of a meter. For the medical community, that number represents a threshold between particles that could spread an infection through the air and particles that couldn't. It was a number long enshrined in the medical literature, but utterly wrong. Megan Multeny is a science writer for Stat News and author of a recent Wired piece titled "The 60-Year-Old Scientific Screw-Up That Helped COVID Kill." She launches her piece with Lindsay Marr, an aerosol scientist at Virginia Tech, on a Zoom call with fateful consequences.
Lindsay Marr studies aerosol science, and she's one of the few people in the world who also studies infectious disease. And that was one of the reasons why she had been recruited to be in this group. It was about 36 aerosol scientists from around the world. And they had basically been seeing the way that COVID was moving around different environments in cruise ships and in restaurants and in call centers. Based on what they knew about how aerosols move in those environments, they thought that SARS-CoV-2 looked like a virus that was moving through the air and not through these droplets that only land a foot or two away, as the WHO had been saying in its daily press briefings and in its materials that it put out on social media. So they had asked for a meeting with the WHO and a number of their expert advisors to basically make a case that they thought something else was going on.
And the WHO, you noted, which had readily accepted that particles of many sizes can hang aloft and travel far and be inhaled in the context of air pollution, simply couldn't extend that acceptance to airborne particles carrying viruses.
For a number of the aerosol scientists on the call, this was kind of shocking to see these physics that they studied in their labs being met with resistance from members of the medical community.
We're talking about two camps on Zoom, you wrote, that literally couldn't understand each other.
Yeah, they really were having a language barrier problem. And and to understand it, you have to understand how each group defined droplets and particles and aerosols that move through the air.
Can you just tell me what the significance of that is?
So the implication from an infection control standpoint is that if a disease is airborne, then you want every healthcare worker who's coming into contact with that patient who has that airborne disease to wear an N95 mask to prevent the smallest aerosols. And then you also want to put that patient in an isolation room so that air is not leaving that room and then recirculating around the hospital. For a droplet-based disease, you would ask the patient to put on a surgical mask to block those droplets. You just take different precautions. You're kind of really elevating things by calling something airborne.
Was there a concern by the people on that call from the WHO that somehow the public wouldn't be able to get their minds around aerosols or that it would needlessly alarm them, something like that?
It's important to remember that, you know, the WHO is a massive international body with lots of different priorities in terms of its public health goals. There was a concern that if they were to call SARS-CoV-2 airborne, that both it would cause a public panic, that people, you know, have not been educated to understand exactly what that means. We've all seen contagion. There's also the concern that if they were to state that it was an airborne disease, they would basically be making the recommendation to nations that they implement these N95s for healthcare workers, implement isolation rooms in hospitals. And these are really big dollar investments that you'd be asking of cash-strapped countries that might leave them without funds to deal with things like malaria or other massive disease burdens that they might also be facing. And at the time, we're talking about beginning of April, the evidence suggested that, you know, it could travel through the air in certain environments, but it didn't look like a classic airborne disease. The outbreaks where it seemed to implicate aerosols were things like the choir in Skagit Valley, Washington, and the cruise ships. It's still within a contained indoor space where ventilation is poor, but it's traveling much further than a meter or two. So it's kind of this in-between zone that the medical community didn't really have a category for.
Stepping out of the interview here for a minute, dividing the two sets of specialists on the Zoom call was a matter of lexicon and a matter of fact. Lexicon first. The medical experts saw the difference between aerosols and droplets as a matter of size. More than 5 microns, it's a droplet. It doesn't hang around in the air. And if a virus spreads by droplets, then hand washing and social distancing are good solutions. The aerosol experts defined particles not by size, but in how they traveled. To them, cruise ships and choir room outbreaks suggested that COVID was an airborne virus. But here the medical folks balked. To them, airborne meant not only a disease that travels by aerosols, the particles smaller than 5 microns, but travels far. Think measles or tuberculosis. And then there was the matter of fact. Lindsay Marr had to burrow deep into the medical history to locate the source. And here the aerosol experts were definitely right, and the medical experts on the call wrong.
Lindsay Marr's deep dive into the history of this 5-micron cutoff took her back to the end of the 19th century, when the idea of miasma theory, that there's poisonous air and it makes you sick, is going out of style because scientists have come up with germ theory and the idea that germs travel on food and in water, and this is how you get sick. And that led to all of these improvements that really did reduce the infectious disease burden in a huge way, except for tuberculosis. Tuberculosis was still this public health scourge. And there was a Harvard engineer named William Firth Wells who offered an explanation for why that would be.
He did an experiment on guinea pigs.
Yes, in a tuberculosis ward at a VA hospital, he pumped in air from the TB patients into this chamber that was housing guinea pigs. And they saw that in chambers that had this infected air, the guinea pigs got sick. And when they autopsied them, they saw the tuberculosis in their lungs. And then they did a control experiment where they used UV light to eliminate the tuberculosis bacterium in the air that was being pumped in. And those guinea pigs did not get sick. And so that was the first time that there was definitive proof that the medical community would accept that airborne diseases were a thing.
But the problem is the size of particles that transmit tuberculosis is around 5 microns, whereas Wells determined that maybe 100 microns could be taken in from the air.
The important thing to know about tuberculosis is that this bacteria only infects a certain kind of lung cell that only lives deep, deep, deep in the lungs. And so the only time you can get infected with tuberculosis is if some of the bacteria makes it all the way into that deepest recess of your lungs. And the only way that happens is if it's carried in a particle smaller than 5 microns. And so what Lindsay Marr's team discovered was that in the historical scientific record, you have this linkage of the 5 microns as being the definition by which any disease is airborne. But the problem is that tuberculosis is this kind of curious, unique critter. And most respiratory viruses and bacteria aren't that picky. And so it wound up not being a very good stand-in for the whole menagerie of respiratory viruses that are out there in the world.
So would you say that this confrontation we began with in 2020 on a Zoom call, has it been resolved?
In some ways, yes. Over the last year, there have been some small steps that the WHO has taken. They changed some language last summer. They updated some ventilation guidance. A few weeks ago, the World Health Organization updated a page on its website titled Coronavirus Disease, How Is It Transmitted? Whereas before, the page had suggested that the main way the virus spreads is by droplets. The revised response now says that it may be these aerosols as well as droplets. And the CDC the next week went a little bit further and stated that, in fact, aerosols are at the top of the list for how the disease spreads.
Now that aerosols have begun to get their due, are people seeing them in the transmission of, you know, annual influenza or a variety of other illnesses where they might not have seen them before?
Well, this is where Lindsay Marr's research really first started. Some of her work in 2011 and 2012 showed that influenza was where people didn't expect it to be. It was in the aerosols. And so there is a renewed interest in going back and looking at the evidence that we've had for this droplet dogma that has for so long reigned. I think what the past year has demonstrated to people is that aerosol science isn't just about climate change and hairspray, but it has really this whole other important application in the world of infectious diseases. The biggest shift that we're seeing right now is a movement away from this dichotomy of saying droplet versus airborne and moving towards something that recognizes that the world is a little bit fuzzier. One new classification system that's being discussed right now is to move to a more mechanistic explanation. And so instead of droplet versus airborne, is to say a respiratory disease is transmitted via inhalation or via touch or via sprayborne. So like when I, you know, sneeze all over someone, you know, because that actually describes how that infectious particle is traveling from one body to another.
Your piece ends with a touching anecdote. Would you describe it?
So anyone who knows Lindsay knows what a stoic and pragmatic and just incredibly hardworking person she is. On the day the CDC changed its update earlier this month, she had heard about it in the frenzy of work and emails. And it wasn't until that evening when she was leaving her house to drive the 15 minutes to pick up her daughter from gymnastics that she was alone for the first time. She was sitting at a stoplight with her blinker on. And all of a sudden, she just found herself crying. This realization that all of the additional work, all the seminars and letters and meetings and pleading with the public health authorities had generated this big change that, from her perspective, will save lives. So she told me last fall that she expected this recognition of the 5-micron error and the kind of subsequent changes would take a generation, it would take 30 years, that she hoped she would live to see it. And so for it to happen in a year, both because of the urgency of the crisis and because of the tenacious pushing that she and others did, the reckoning that this pandemic has led to will have positive consequences for public health that long outlive this pandemic.
Megan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Megan Multeny is a science writer for Stat News and author of a recent Wired piece titled "The 60-Year-Old Screw-Up That Helped COVID Kill." Coming up, you think you live online now? Welcome to the multiverse. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Much about life is maddening and confusing. It's natural to feel that we as individuals lack the agency to fix the world's woes. That's why many of us turn to the power we do have, which is to leave it all behind. Call it distraction or denialism, escapism, or just plain human nature. We're prone to create and inhabit imaginary lives through books, movies, our own imaginations, or increasingly, technology.
Imagine for a moment a world that has everything you could ever dream of. Every kind of store you can imagine is there and open 24/7. And if you're tired of storms, it never rains there. Weather's perfect. So where is this magical place? It's the metaverse.
The metaverse, the chosen name for the virtual reality-powered successor to our current internet, has reached full-on buzzword status in 2021. Some credit for the hype could go to Tim Sweeney, CEO of Epic Games, who kicked off this company's high-profile antitrust lawsuit against Apple earlier this month by defining Fortnite, his crown jewel, as a metaverse. Fortnite is the most popular video game of all time. Gamers have logged a stunning 3.8 billion cumulative days of playtime on its servers. But is it really a metaverse? In a minute, I think we'll find out what that means. Meanwhile, catchy stories of technological advancement generate headlines and big money in Silicon Valley and Wall Street.
Here's a recent article from Forbes. The metaverse is coming, and it's a very big deal.
It is a brave new, I can't even say world, metaverse, brave new metaverse here with digital.
JP Morgan, bullish on the metaverse's potential for ads and e-commerce.
The cash grab may have just begun, but the promises and pitfalls of a three-dimensional inhabitable internet is well-trod ground in science fiction.
Behold, the internet!
Like this Futurama episode in which our 31st century protagonists log on to the metaverse.
My God! It's full of ads!
Only to be literally attacked by pop-ups.
Follow me!
It's immense!
The real metaverse may be years or decades off, but Gene Park, who covers video games for The Washington Post, is watching its development with anxiety and excitement.
The metaverse is basically thought of as the next version of the internet. A virtual world having its own economy where the inhabitants, internet users, would be able to kind of coexist online, doing work as they would in their real life. Of course, there will be avatars and there'll be like actualized places.
Like magic castles or Starbucks? Is this a place you would go to escape the real world? Or is it just another place of business?
Some people would want to use it as a form of escape. But I think for a real metaverse to function, it would be a place where people would go to work.
I'm still trying to get a handle on what it would look like. What would it feel like?
Virtual reality is probably the simplest way to kind of imagine it. That's the way that it's been imagined for decades, stemming from the 1990 Neal Stephenson book, Snow Crash. Snow Crash coined the term the metaverse, and the most famous depiction of a metaverse would be the book and the Steven Spielberg film, Ready Player One.
And for those who haven't read it, can you summarize that?
Yeah, Ready Player One envisions a corporation that has established the metaverse. Imagine Facebook with like 100 times more power, and the main character has to find a secret of why the company was started. But within his adventures within that metaverse, he's able to interact with so many different IP, from cartoons, sports figures, to books that he used to read or shows that he used to watch, because they all coexist within this space. Much like Fortnite. Fortnite already has different characters and different IP from different companies all clashing together in one existing space.
But I always thought Fortnite basically was a shooting game.
Fortnite has definitely evolved into more of a social networking platform in which you still shoot other characters, right? But they've also now included features where you don't have to do any of that stuff. You can just hang out and talk. And it's kind of become like the Gen Z Zoom, where people will go on Fortnite and just kind of meet and talk and sit together and watch a movie in Fortnite.
Travis Scott, the rapper, he had a 15-minute concert in April last year.
I would absolutely call the Travis Scott April concert a turning point for Fortnite and for its metaverse ambitions. That was his largest attempt yet at being able to kind of create like a gathering space for people and for having a reason outside the game for tens of millions of people to log onto the game.
46 million watched it and danced along.
Yeah, that's quite an attendance figure for a concert, wouldn't you think? Sun is down, I'm freezing cold. That's how we
already know when it's here. My dog. Here's the thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know how different this is from Second Life. I mean, back in the aughts, Regina mm-hmm. Spektor performed songs from her then new album on Second Life mm-hmm. in a virtual New York City loft. Mm-hmm. You could do all those cultural things there. You could spend money. Mm-hmm. People flirted. They even married. They built second lives there. How is this different? What makes this different?
Second Life is absolutely one of the first real attempts at creating something like this. The problem was is that it definitely never attracted the millions of people it would need to kind of enter the serious conversations with metaverse. Whereas Fortnite and the other video game Roblox, they have attracted hundreds of millions of people. And the difference between Second Life and Fortnite is that with Fortnite, they were able to, you know, for lack of a better term, lure regular folks in, as well as gamers, you know?
So what you're saying is that the game was the gateway drug.
Yes, exactly. That's a great way to put it.
Also, I have to assume, you know, since Second Life was back in the aughts, that it didn't have the technology, the sense of reality that these worlds intend to employ.
Absolutely. Second Life looks very ancient by now. Fortnite is improving constantly, but it still doesn't have the capacity to hold massive amounts of people. We've talked about how 46 million people watch Travis Scott. Unfortunately, all of those 46 million people were divided up into rooms made of 100 other people, right? We're not all able to coexist in the same space. That's why the metaverse doesn't exist today. I think a lot of the reason why conversation around this metaverse, which isn't exclusively a video game concept, is happening around the video game industry is because there's nothing on Facebook or Twitter, for example, that looks anything like the kinds of images that we get in video games and the kind of reality that they're able to create.
So the metaverse is being heralded as the internet's future, but can we talk a little bit about how it's both new and old? I'm thinking more of like vision quests, where instead of technology, you could use a drug or a mushroom to place you in a truly different realm.
I see a lot of similarities between drug experiences and virtual worlds and video games too, you know. Even the Travis Scott concert was a very psychedelic experience. It was like a 90-foot tall giant as colorful explosions explode behind him. It definitely felt like a very surreal kind of drug trippy experience.
And I was thinking about the games predating the internet that sort of enabled us to inhabit an alternate persona in an alternate world, like live-action role-playing, LARPing, or just what young kids do in every generation whenever they're left alone.
Absolutely. I've once described Fortnite as having the same story that I created when I was bashing two action figures together in the bathtub when I was 6 years old, you know?
It seems, though, like the metaverse will eventually feel less like a game and maybe not a world so much as a big, immersive, snazzed-out platform where you can buy anything you want. And that's not such a new phenomenon. Why all the hype about this digital metaverse as the future of the internet? I'm not sure what makes it a breakthrough.
Yeah, I think it's really hard to even envision it right now because there are so many companies having different ideas about it. Facebook, for example, invested years ago in its virtual reality platform for Oculus Quest, and they're set to launch Horizon, which is basically a virtual world to explore, play, and create, as they say. And then, of course, there's Epic Games and Tim Sweeney.
That's the guy behind Fortnite. Epic CEO Tim Sweeney warned that if one company ends up gaining control of the metaverse, it will become, quote, more powerful than any government and be a god on earth.
Facebook dominates so much of the internet, right? Google and Facebook. It would behoove whatever company to build whatever next version of the internet might be to be in that position. So I think there's a lot of jockeying for that position right now.
When Michael Loewinger, who's producing this two-way, was talking to me about this, you know, I always loved the idea of alternate worlds. His concern was that this idea, whether darkly conceived by Philip K. Dick or Neal Stephenson or gloriously imagined, simply becomes just another way to monetize us. I want to think that there is magic out there, but whenever these big platforms get hold of it, it's just kind of ick.
That's kind of why I wrote that article back in April, to sound a light alarm. For me, as someone who has worked for newspapers for the last 20 years, you know, I care very much about how people receive the news. And if the media industry is about to be disrupted once again, newspapers are still catching up to the current reality of the internet, right? So I fear for the media industry overall. And I absolutely share any fears about what this might look like and how much of it is an attempt to turn us into capital. We've had so many examples of this in recent years. I'm hoping this time that once the internet changes again, more people will at least be a little bit ready for it.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Brooke.
Jean Park is a reporter at the Washington Post covering video games. From an imagined future online to a palpable one on Earth, the Future Library is inviting 100 writers, one every year, to contribute to a collection that will be published in 2014. They're also growing 1,000 trees for 100 years to print 3,000 copies of 100 manuscripts. The Future Library also includes instructions on how to make paper, and there's a printing press, again with instructions in case we forgot how to use it. So far, 7 authors have contributed, the latest being Ocean Vuong. The New York Times described the project as the literary equivalent of a seed bank. Margaret Atwood was the first contributor, and when I spoke to her back in 2015, I asked if she saw the enterprise that way. that this might persist as a kind of safe haven for literature in case all else fails.
Anytime you write something, you're always anticipating a future reader. Even if it's your diary, you're anticipating yourself at a future point in time. Just as when you write down a musical score, you're anticipating a future player who will come along and unlock the score and turn it back into music again. A seed bank is the same idea. You put the seeds in there with the idea that somebody will, in the future, plant them.
I'm just wondering if there was a difference writing for readers who aren't born yet.
Are we talking about the idea of me maybe dying? Is that the subject here? Any book, when you write it, there's always a time gap between when you write it and when somebody else reads it. It's just that the time gap is a little bit longer. Well, be frank, quite a lot longer.
But didn't you say that readers might need a paleoanthropologist to enjoy the book?
Yeah, we know how language changes over time. And we know that words are appearing all the time. Words are changing their meanings all of the time. We know that we can still understand Shakespeare, though the further along in time we go, the more footnotes we need.
The Future Library is described as a hopeful project because it's based on the belief that humans will exist 100 years from now. Is that a high bar?
I don't think it's a terribly high bar, but there are a lot of other things involved too. So humans will exist, but will they exist in Oslo, for instance? Trees will grow, but will they grow there? Will people be able to read? Will they wish to read? These are all things that we don't know yet. And they're going to ask for contributions from all around the globe, from any language. Some of those languages may be quite small. Maybe the languages themselves will be extinct in 100 years. And if so, should they be putting in a dictionary?
This is a question, if you got up and left right now, I wouldn't be surprised. But I'm going to ask you anyway. What do you think the world's going to be like in 100 years?
Well, now, the good news from the physicists is that time really does move in one direction. Things aren't all simultaneous the way they were in Slaughterhouse-5. So choices you make now actually can influence the future. The bad news is that Donald Rumsfeld was right about one thing. It's the unknown unknowns that get you. So we don't know about the unknown unknowns. We know about some of the knowns. We know that our actions can change some of those knowns. I just read in the paper today that the cod fishery has rebounded.
That is actually very encouraging.
Don't you think? Something has rebounded. We hear about all these things bounding, but we don't hear about them rebounding. So the other thing that's helpful is that there's a great endeavor underway to plant a lot of milkweed so that the monarch butterflies will rebound. And a man has discovered that one of the biggest soakers up of oil spills is actually milkweed fluff that he's making into oil spill sucker uppers. And he's got a bunch of farmers growing milkweed for this project. So people are very ingenious and they come up with all kinds of solutions.
You know, I have to admit, I'm a little taken aback by how positive you sound. Your imagined worlds are so dystopian.
It's not all bad. Duct tape has survived the meltdown of the human race. It's very positive. I'm happy that there's duct tape. The thing about my books is they're books. And just think of it this way. We've known how for decades to blow ourselves up with atomic bombs, and we haven't done it yet.
A character in The Blind Assassin said, "Why is it we want so badly to memorialize ourselves? Even while we're still alive, we wish to assert our existence like dogs peeing on fire hydrants. We monogram our linen, we carve our names on trees, we scrawl them on washroom walls. It's the same impulse. What do we hope to get from it?" And you said, or the character said, "We can't stand the idea of our own voices falling silent, finally, like a radio running down."
Is what she says true?
Is it?
Is it? I'm asking you. You're the reader.
It sounds right. No one wants to die. And I guess that's the impulse for writing. But when you're staring 100 years from now in the face, did it make a difference that you wouldn't be here 100 years from now, other than the fact that you wouldn't have to confront the critics?
Young people worry a lot more than older people. And the reason they worry a lot more than older people is that they don't know the plot of their own lives yet. They don't know how it's going to turn out for them. Will they meet their true love? Will they be successful? At my age, I kind of know how the story goes. So, should I get hit by a truck tomorrow, the plot will pretty much have unfolded.
And the rest of the human race?
Well, of course I worry about them, but they have to worry about themselves because it's not going to be my problem very shortly. It will, however, be theirs.
Margaret Atwood, thank you very much.
And thank you very much. How old are you anyway?
60.
Oh, you're a mere child.
Yeah, right.
No wonder you're so worried.
Actually, less and less every day. I noticed
yeah,
that.
Yeah, this is what I mean. Yeah, I could have been your babysitter and popped you into the microwave. No, I take that back.
They didn't have microwaves when
no,
I was
they didn't. Yes, yes, yes. I thought you might spot that.
Margaret Atwood is the author of many, many books. Her most recent novel is The Testaments, a sequel to the iconic 1985 The Handmaid's Tale.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
Letting the days go by, let the water hold me down. Letting the days go by, water flowing underground. Into the blue again, after the money's gone, once in a lifetime.
On the Media is produced by Leah Feder, Micah Loewinger, John Hanrahan, Eloise Blondio, and Rebecca Clark Callender. Sandra Ellen writes our newsletter. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Adrian Lilly. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.